we come now to the other balancing factor with the compassion, the quality of equanimity. And the quality of equanimity is very important in compassion, in our experience of compassion, and particularly in not being overwhelmed by the empathetic abilities in our heart. There's a lot of suffering in the world. There's a lot of suffering in the world, and having a balanced perspective is key to our being able to make contact with it, but not fall apart with that contact. And equanimity is a accumulation, you might say, a culmination is the word I meant, a culmination of practice. Like, it is not where we start with practice, it's the result of practice. And equanimity, it's interesting, it's listed in many, many lists that the Buddha made, and it's often the last element in it. You know, in the for those of you who know these lists, if you don't worry about this too much. The seven factors of enlightenment, equanimity is the last one. Four Brahma Viharas that we're working with, the loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. And there's many other places that it shows up. And in many ways, this quality of equanimity is a taste that is available to us in moments of our lives of freedom. It is here for us and gives us a sense of being able to be in the world without being bowled over by it. So a little bit about this quality of equanimity. And the Buddha talked about this quality of equanimity as a mind filled with equanimity as abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will. That sounds pretty good, doesn't it? And it keeps going. The word upekkha is the word used in the Pali for that. That's the language of the Buddha. That's what the actual Pali word, upekkha. And it means, if you break it down, it means to look over. And another way of interpreting it is to stand in the middle. To stand in the middle of all of this. So it's the ability to see over things without getting caught in them, or to stand in the middle of it without getting lost. Sometimes it's used, a colloquial translation might be to see with patience or to see with understanding. And we'll come back to this quality of understanding that is embedded in the quality of equanimity. Another way it's talked about it is grandmotherly love. So what's that, you know, as a parent, if you're going through this for the first time being a parent, then, you know, every time your child trips or something, it's a major event. When you're a grandparent, you've kind of seen it all before. So you're compassionate and you care and you're there, but you aren't getting thrown around in the same way. Some of you, I'm sure, in here are grandparents and can recognize this quality. Other words that are used to describe this quality, because as I say it, see if you can recognize some of these words in your own experience. Some might resonate with you and others not so much. Evenness, spaciousness, openness, unshakability, and steadiness. relaxed, centered. That's a word culturally we use a lot, that one feels centered. Non-resistant, confident, a vitality or integrity that can keep us upright, like ballast keeps a ship upright in strong winds. An ability to write up. You know, I think of those, some of you, as I do that, you might think of those like dolls or big blown up mannequins that they blow over and then it goes boop and it comes back up. That's sort of this quality of equanimity. Still here. Still here. So there's some components to equanimity that are important to acknowledge and name as we move towards this quality. One of them is the clarity to see things as they are. So this I'm going to come back to quite a bit. That we're in contact with the truth. We're not pretending it's other than it is. Very important quality. And this is why we started with compassion, is its connection. The second quality is being connected to the world. Not of it, but connected to it, to the experience or what's before us. Another aspect is a kind of confidence or faith in the natural unfolding. And I will come back to this quite a bit. It's like this is a realization that things happen as the result of conditions. And something just doesn't happen as a random occurrence. And this gives us a sense of understanding. I'll come back and explain that more. There's also in it a quality, in this quality of equanimity, a lot of peace and ease. This ongoing contact with the truth has a relaxed easefulness with it, a way of being. And the last one that's important is that having equanimity actually gives us a great amount of energy to do, to act. It frees us up. It frees up the energy we often have stirred up in emotional content and wishing it was other and arguing with reality, and all that energy is freed up and we have the capacity to act. And this equanimity is really what a lot of us are looking for in our practice. This is one of the very, when we have equanimity, we may not be naming it that way, and you might sense times in your life or just a certain moments of experience where there is equanimity, the ability to respond, you're right there, you're present, you see what's happening. And in many ways, this is what all of us want in our lives, the ability to respond appropriately. And part of this is the responding appropriately to the fact that life is all over the place. We talk about the eight great vicissitudes of life. And these are the ups and downs that are built in to the way things are. The changing of gain and loss. I'll read you some. I'll name the eight vicissitudes. Gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute, and pleasure and pain. These are the eight that the Buddha named as like, these things were always going from one to the other. And equanimity is this quality that can give us some place to rest in the midst of all that happening. Here's a poem from Izumi Shikibu. Although the wind blows terribly here, the moonlight also leaks between the roof planks of this ruined house. A lot of haiku and Japanese poetry points to this, these vicissitudes and the equanimity in the middle of it. Can you hear that? The gain and loss. And when you hear a poem like that, there's sort of, you can just sense kind of a midpoint, oh, a resting point. I'll read it again. Although the wind blows terribly here, the moonlight also leaks between the roof planks of this ruined house. And this gain and loss happens, you know, in many ways in our lives. Financial, things go up and down. How do we hold the equanimity in that? Sometimes there's abundance, sometimes there's not. A real place of gain and loss that I'm very familiar with is within in the body. I really notice I've had quite a few things happen in my body over the last, well, many years, but it's been a little denser over the last five. And it's like, oh, okay, now I can't do this. Can I be okay with that? And as somebody who has actually been very athletic and active, at first it was quite, at times it can be quite challenging. And finding the midpoint in that, like, yep, that's the way it is. That's the way it is. Can I be in the midst of this in contact with the sadness of not being able to do it? You know? And yet, okay. I had my arm in a cast for about, it was in and out of a cast and surgery and stuff for about a year. And it was interesting having the experience that just little things that I would take for granted, I could no longer do. You know, you can't even like put your hair, braid your hair or get it out of your face or, you know, let alone, you know, get in a kayak or something like that. You know, and how to just go, yeah, this is the way it is. It's sad. I would rather be able to use my other arm. I look forward and I hope that I can again. But this is the way it is. I'm not going to pretend that it's some other way. I'm not going to resist it. Here it is. Another one of those, praise and blame. And that's a really interesting, because the more dependent we are on praise, the more susceptible we are to blame. If we're looking for praise, then the blame really hits us. You know, and they've done these social experiments. I'm not up on the specifics of science, but of a lot of the experiments, but you hear commonly that like 6 to 1, that it takes 6 positive comments for most of us to offset 1 criticism. And it really shows how we orient towards the problem, the critique. But it really shows that if you take that 1 criticism very seriously, in the sense of like feeling crushed by it, doesn't mean you can't take the content out of it. Maybe there's something useful there, but by feeling crushed by it, oh my God, then you are completely, then now you got to find 6 people who are going to say something positive. That's a lot of work. So how to stand in the midst of that? How to stand in the midst of that? This is Basho. Since my house burned down, I have a better view of the moon. Oof. Not sure I'm quite ready to be that equanimous, but you know, with equanimity, we have the opportunity to ride our way through the waves of change that are inevitable. And I hope you're hearing in this, we're not flattening it out. We're not expecting, as a result of equanimity, that we all this somehow is going to stop happening to us. That's delusion. It's still going to happen. You know, that's that thing that we somehow think, you know, what is it? We all don't like it when bad things happen to good people. It's like, how could that possibly happen to that person? You know, they're such a good person. Stuff still happens. And it doesn't mean that somebody's done something wrong or they've erred, or it's just stuff happens. How to sit in the midst of that. So, let me read you a. This is the Buddha talking to his son Rahula and encouraging him towards equanimity. And he says, Rahula, that's the name of his son, Rahula, develop a meditation that is like the earth. For then agreeable and disagreeable sensory impressions will not take charge of your mind. Just as when people throw what is clean and unclean on the earth, excrement, urine, saliva, pus, or blood, the earth is not horrified, humiliated, or disgusted by it. In the same way, agreeable and disagreeable sensory impressions will not take charge of your mind when you develop a meditation like the earth. I particularly like that because there's a steadiness in it, and for me, a connecting to the earth and feeling that. There's also a challenge in it because acknowledging that the earth has a lot of equanimity in its own way, and even the earth is being overwhelmed. So no matter who we are, there's going to be generally times that we get overwhelmed, that we start to lose our equanimity. There's a great story of the Buddha. At some point, a bunch of monks were having a big argument back and forth, and he tried to get them to agree and tried to talk sense to them. And then at some point he just goes, "This is wearisome. I'm leaving." In almost so many words. And he leaves. He goes off by himself and just says, "You guys work it out." You know, I mean, you can feel his equanimity was like right there at the edge and he'd had enough. And I say that because I don't think it's useful to have some idea that we're going to get this isn't about somehow being another way to that we should be perfect. It's all imperfect and moving. And that's what part of the equanimity is being willing to be with all the imperfection. Because that's the nature of it, of us, of experience, of the body. And if we understand that and lose the idea that it's supposed to be perfect, then the way it is perfect. I have a friend who had after a lot of practice, had a lot of awakeness, a lot of deep understanding in her. And she started going around and just going, you know, when something would happen, she would just laugh and go, "Oh, that's perfect." And for a long time, I would go, "No, it's not." And eventually I started to understand what she was saying. It's like perfect in the sense that's the truth. That's the way it is right now. We know because it's already happened. It's perfect. It's the natural unfolding. And here we are. This is the way it is. So I want to say a little bit about what equanimity is not. I've sort of been hinting at it here. But it's not, I'm fine. You know, somebody, yes, everything's fine. You know, a kind of indifference or trying to be above it all or suppress it and push it away. Like kind of trying to hold detachment. That's not what we're pointing to. This is from Ajahn Chah. Said, once I had a disciple who stayed in a grass-roofed hut. It rained often that rainy season, and one day a strong wind blew off half the roof. He did not bother to fix it, just let it rain in. Several days passed, and I asked him about his hut. He said he was practicing non-clinging. This is non-clinging without wisdom. It is about the same as the equanimity of a water buffalo. He was not impressed. So, you know, it's not about suppressing our experience, about being stoic. You know, I can make it through this. I'm going to stay there. I know as a kid, I don't know about you, and then as a young adult, I developed a lot of a certain kind of stoicism. Like, okay, I can do this. Okay, that's not what I, you know, somebody does something, it's like, okay, fine. I don't need you anyway. And off you go, you know? It's not like that. It's letting the world impact us and being okay. Another way that sometimes we can, that isn't equanimity, but we think it is avoiding the pain, not letting ourselves feel it, or avoiding circumstances that might elicit it. Another one that's trickier is getting into a place where we use ideas about the ultimate, about emptiness and about how everything is one and it's called spiritual bypass. That's not equanimity. I did have an experience once on a retreat. It was a wilderness retreat, and there was somebody who was having a hard time. Like, we would be leaving camp and they weren't ready and they hadn't even shown up, and I talked to them and they were very upset, and then they were just like, but everything's one and everything's fine and what's the problem? And I'm like, everything's one and we all need to leave camp at the same time. You know, I mean, we can use it as a kind of non-contactfulness with other people and reality. This isn't common for us, but I say it in case you're playing around in the field of emptiness and oneness. Don't get stuck there. And then another way that we can just also be numb. Numbness, indifference, these are not equanimity. These are what we, dissociation, all of these are ways that we're distancing ourselves. We're not standing in the middle. We're way off to the side. So there are two elements of wisdom that are very important for us in order for the equanimity to grow. And these two are kamma or karma, is it? Karma, for those of you, for everyone, the karma is the Sanskrit word, and it's the one that we've adopted into our language. And kamma is the Pali version of the same word, which was the language the Buddha originally talked in. So karma and non-identification, not self. These are closely related but slightly different. And both of these are useful and supporting our equanimity. And I'm going to talk about karma for a little bit first, because understanding karma helps us a lot moving towards equanimity. And the fundamental aspect of this is realizing that and acknowledging that causes and conditions are happening, that things are the result of things that happened, that one thing affects another, that the world is not random. And if we think about it, we know this. You know, what's also true is that it's impossible to know all the conditions. We might know some of them. And often what bothers us is that we can't see some of the conditioning elements and we look for them. One of the challenges, one of the things that happened as this idea of karma came over into the country and sort of a new age version of it, was basically you are responsible for all your karma, and everything that happens to you is because of something you did. And the Buddha did not talk about it that way. He said there's many conditions. One of the conditions is your personal karma, the conditions that you have put out there in the world, the things that you have done personally. But he also gave a list. There's actually five different karmas that he calls them, the five niyamas. And karma, the personal karma, is one of them. So one of them is physical laws. So that's like just the basic conditions of physics and chemistry and the seasons, the day. Like, this is one of the factors that's constantly playing in, right? Winter, you know, it may, one of the conditions in an accident, say, that happens is that it's winter and you slid on snow or ice. So there's the factor of winter in there, which isn't personal to you. That's one of the things. Another one is biological laws, biological conditions. So, you know, this is, if you plant a mango seed and you're hoping for an oak tree, you're leaving out, you know, no matter how earnest your effort, that's not what's going to happen. And in this biological one, one that affects us more directly, is the acknowledgement of genetics and our own, the body, heart, mind that we came in with. And we do not get to control that. We all know this, of course, but there's some way we take it personally that, you know, one person we think is pretty and we're not. And it's like somehow we take it as a personal failure that we don't have that gene. And yet, how could it possibly be a failure? Or the many, many, many other factors in the genetics. A lot of times, you know, this is like one of the things that I think of is, you know, when somebody gets cancer. These days, one of the things we're all, you know, we want to know is like, well, why? And part of the reason we want to know why when someone gets cancer is because we want to know how they're different from us. So it's important to acknowledge that. Or if you have cancer, I've had cancer myself, and it's like, okay, what did I do that caused that to happen. And we're getting confused there. There may be some conditions that we got to participate in, you know, and but we know that there's many different factors. That's why they, you know, you see the person who at 102 is smoking like a, you know, a band and all these packs of cigarettes everywhere. And it's like, how did they get away with that? You know, and somebody else doesn't. So there's conditions that we put in, but this genetics is very important. Another law that the Buddha pointed to is psychological laws. In other words, how our mind works, how it unfolds, how things affect us, and then how we respond and carry that. This is part of, you know, our whole developmental experience. And then there's what he called the natural laws. That's like the laws of that everything is impermanent, that there is suffering and there is a cause of suffering and a freedom from it. So things that are there, whether or not truths about the way the world is, that are there whether we acknowledge them or not, and that are not particular to a particular philosophy, or it, they're just, that's the way it is. So all of these factors come together, and part of connecting, part of the openness and connecting and the compassion is realizing that all these conditions are coming together, and there's this, what's arising in the moment, this suffering arising here. And we can allow our compassion to meet this moment while also understanding that there's these myriad conditions that have come to play. And so in supporting compassion in this way, the heart opens and has some stability, and we have a sense of steadiness, but still meeting the truth that in this moment, these conditions have come together in this way. This in some ways has that, I mentioned in the guided meditation, the great compassion. And the great compassion is this holding of the playing out of conditions, of being able to be compassionate and seeing the big picture. A kind of impartiality. And when we sense this whole realm of conditioning, conditioned unfolding that we can't control, then compassion is the only possible response. When we see that it's just unfolding again and again. Bernie Glassman says it quite well. He says, it's about living a questioning life, a life of unknowing. If we're ready to live such a life without fixed ideas or answers, then we are ready to bear witness to every situation, no matter how difficult, offensive, or painful it is. Out of that process of bearing witness, the right action of making peace and healing arises. So there's a way that we're having the courage to meet the present moment by understanding that so much has come into it. Nyanaponika says, and this Equanimity is an even unwavering courage and fearlessness, enabling compassion to face the awesome abyss of misery and despair. Both are there. So another aspect, another wisdom component that needs to come in is understanding this non-identification, not taking it personally. So this is very closely tied to what I was just talking about, that it's not an attack on me or on you, that we're seeing the impersonal nature of this unfolding. Winter is not about me. Even my genetics, we can take them personally, but it was not meant as a curse on me. And many, you know, even something as mundane, but we all know about this. Somebody says something quite unpleasant, perhaps even mean to us, and our first instinct is to take it very personally. Wow, they're attacking me. And then we might realize, oh, even that isn't about me. It's about their experience, their day, their history. Everything that's happening for that person in that moment, all these conditions coming together. And yes, it's unfortunate to be on the receiving end, and it's unpleasant and it's painful, and it's not personal. It's all the conditions coming together. This is part of the understanding that these conditions are happening in us and in you and in between us all. Ajahn Chah talks about it this way, the impersonal unfolding of it. Try to be mindful and let things take their natural course. Then your mind will become quieter and quieter in any surroundings. It will become still like a clear forest pool. Then all kinds of wonderful and rare animals will come to drink at the pool. You will see clearly the nature of all things in the world. You will see many wonderful and strange things come and go, but you will be still. Problems will arise, and you will see through them immediately. This is the happiness of the Buddha. That stillness he's referring to is this standing in the midst of, this ability to be there and watch all these crazy animals come and go. There's this sense of balance here, but also responsiveness. The ability to do. There's a great story of a Zen master. Once somebody asked him, so what is the purpose of a life of practice? And his answer was an appropriate response. Seems so simple. And really, that's what I get after a whole life of practice? But how fabulous is that, to have an appropriate response, not be reactive, to be there, to respond. You know, it's the image that you probably may have seen it at some point. I think it was, I'm trying to remember who, to Yogananda, but the picture of the guru on a surfboard in tree pose on thing, and the caption is, you can't stop the waves, but you can learn to surf, you know, and he's got this picture of him standing on the surfboard down a wave in tree pose. It was before Photoshop, so I wonder how they did it. But you know, how do we find this place? And that's a big part of our practice, to keep finding our way, understanding this. Ajahn Jumian says, at some point the mind becomes so clear and balanced that whatever arises is seen and left untouched with no interference. One ceases to focus on any particular content, and all is seen simply as mind and matter, an empty process arising and passing away of its own, a perfect balance of mind with no reactivity. Nice. There's something else I was gonna... Li Po puts it this way. The birds have vanished into the sky, and now the last cloud drains away. We sit together, the mountain and me, until only the mountain remains. Completely in the moment and okay with it. How can we play with this? Am I okay right now? You can ask yourself that. Am I okay right now? And sometimes when things get really bumpy for me and something's going on, I can ask, am I okay right now? And somewhere in there, I can find that ballast in the ship and go, yeah, I'm still okay right now. I've told this story a few times, but I think it's useful because it's not unfamiliar. It was about a couple years ago now. I was teaching at Spirit Rock, and I... woke up in the morning and I had abdominal pain, and it got worse and worse, and finally somebody, you know, I tried heating pads and things like that, and finally somebody said, you need to go get this checked out. So I went, I was taken, I couldn't drive, I was in too much pain, and I was taken to an urgent care there, and the urgent care wasn't open yet, we had miscalculated, and so it was about an hour, and I was sitting in this chair out in this sort of empty room. And at times, this pain would get quite intense. And then I would ask myself, am I okay now? And I'd go, yeah, this is really painful, and I'm okay. And then later, I went in there, and they were like, you have to go to the emergency room, higher level. So I went there, and they didn't know what it was, and there would just be these periods of time where I was in great pain, and I would keep asking myself, and I'm like, I'm okay. There's people here who are doing the best they can, and they, for some reason, they couldn't give me pain medication, maybe because they thought I was possibly heading to surgery, which was where I was headed, and so they needed to leave my system alone. So I remember just keep coming back and going, yeah, this isn't where I was planning to spend the day, but I'm okay. And I remember it was very, very clear. I had this really clear moment because I remember looking up at the clock, and it was 7:30 in the evening. So, of course, you know, it'd been all day. And it's 7:30 in the evening, and they were wheeling me into the operating room. And I was like, right, 7:30. I was supposed to give the Dharma talk today. I'm okay. You know, we just don't know. We just don't know. And can we continue to be okay in the midst of it all? That's our challenge. And yet, I feel like equanimity, the way I experience it, is it's like this big container, vast, boundless, as the Buddha said, that we can, sometimes it's only out of the corner of our eye, we can recognize that it's there. But it's there. And then in the midst of all that, everything, life keeps happening. It doesn't stop life from happening. But the container is there. A kind of spaciousness. Ajahn Sumedho expressed it beautifully when, in his classic phrase, he says, "It's like this. It's like this." And sometimes that's a wonderful way of reminding ourselves when something's happening. It's like this. Or some people use, "and this too." And this too. Room for everything to come and go. I'm going to end with a story. It's called Golfing in Calcutta. The story is told of a golf course in India. Apparently, once the English had colonized the country and established their businesses, they yearned for recreation and decided to build a golf course in Calcutta. Golf in Calcutta presented a unique obstacle. Monkeys would drop out of the trees, scurry across the course, and seize the golf balls. The monkeys would play with the balls, tossing them here and there. At first, the golfers tried to control the monkeys. Their first strategy was to build high fences around the fairways and greens. This approach, which seemed initially to hold much promise, was abandoned when golfers discovered that a fence is no challenge to an ambitious monkey. Next, the golfers tried to luring the monkeys away from the course, but the monkeys found nothing as amusing as watching humans go wild whenever their little white balls were disturbed. In desperation, the British began trapping the monkeys, but for every monkey they carted off, another would appear. Finally, the golfers gave in to reality and developed a rather novel ground rule. Play the ball where the monkey drops it. So let's sit together for a moment and let the words settle.